Today, actions have consequences. The DFA Daily to the 10th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Last week, Westpac announced the results of its investigation into anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing, the AML-CTF compliance issues. Moody's says the results are credit negative as they highlight a number of weaknesses in Westpac's AML-CTF frameworks. Compliance issues of this nature demonstrate the corporate governance difficulties of maintaining tight controls at large and complex institutions and the negative spillover effects for bank reputations, as well as costs relating to remedial action and potential fines. Westpac's review began on the 28th of November 2019 in response to the commencement of civil proceedings on the 20th of November 2019 against the bank by the Australian Transaction Reports and Analysis Centre, or AUSTRAC, in relation to alleged breaches of AML and CTF laws. In particular, AUSTRAC alleges that during 2013 through 19, Westpac maintained inadequate reporting of millions of international funds transfer instructions, the IFTIs, and they failed to carry out adequate risk assessments of correspondent banks, and they failed to adopt and maintain an AML-CTF program, and they failed to conduct adequate ongoing due diligence and enhance customer due diligence. AUSTRAC also alleges that the Westpac board did not provide adequate oversight in relation to these matters. On the 15th of May 2020, Westpac filed a defence to the AUSTRAC allegations, and while Westpac has admitted to a majority of the breaches, a small number of errors remain to be resolved through the current legal process. During the first half of fiscal year 2020, that's ending the 30th September 2020, Westpac highlighted an after-tax $1 billion charge in relation to these AUSTRAC matters, and the review identified three primary causes of the AML-CTF compliance failures. First, the review highlighted that AML-CTF risk was not always well understood across Westpac. Parts of the bank did not have a clear understanding and appreciation of AML and CTF risk, how it should be managed, and the specialist capabilities required to manage this risk. Second, there were unclear end-to-end accountabilities for managing AML-CTF compliance. And finally, Westpac's financial crimes control framework did not have enough employees with sufficient skills, expertise, and experience to effectively manage AML-CTF risk. Westpac had appointed a panel of three independent experts to review whether its board processes were adequate and whether the diligence by directors was adequate. The panel's recommendations include the creation of clear accountabilities and reporting for AML-CTF compliance, clarifying the responsibilities within the three lines of defence for financial crime risk, rebuilding the relationship with AUSTRAC, observing and learning from global best practice, and reviewing how the Westpac board monitors its need to meet AML-CTF obligations. And the panel also suggested that Westpac accelerates existing work on culture, governance and accountability. Such work to strengthen its AML-CTF controls had already been commenced following the bank's self-reporting to AUSTRAC in 2018 for its failure to report a large number of IFTIs. Westpac says it's accepted these recommendations and has ensured that they are captured in its remediation programme of work. More broadly, Australia's banking sector has taken a collective hit to its bottom line, despite a 20% increase in residential mortgage volumes, according to new APRA data. Bank profits have fallen 14%, despite a $16 billion rise in approvals, as reported in Mortgage Business. According to the latest quarterly property exposure statistics from the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, APRA, the banking sector collectively settled $94.9 billion in mortgages in the 3 months to 31st of March 2020, up 20.1% from the $79 billion in the previous corresponding period. The improvement was driven by a surge in owner-occupied lending, with volumes rising by approximately $10.4 billion from $54.1 to $64.5 billion over the same period. Investor volumes also increased, up by approximately $5.2 billion from $22.7 billion to $27.9 billion. External refinances made up just approximately 37% of new loans settled, and the value of refinancing volumes was up 24% to $35.2 billion. This coincides with a sharp fall in mortgage rates from a weighted average of 4.2% in the March quarter of 2019 to a weighted average of 3.1%, reflecting 5.25 basis point cuts from the RBA. And as Reuters pointed out, Australian banks doubled their lending to the most leveraged homeowners in the March quarter, just as the country shut its economy due to the COVID-19, data shows, putting them at risk of acute mortgage stress if prices fall as predicted. Figures released on Tuesday by the banking regulator show that new home loans to borrowers with deposits of 5% or less of their home value increased $1.8 billion in the 3 months to March. That's a 52% jump from the $1.2 billion the banks lent to the most leveraged cohort a year before. And while the $19.5 billion in highly leveraged mortgages represents a small proportion of the $1.73 trillion home loan market, a 10% decline in home prices, which are expected by economists, could put the value of these properties below their loans. APRA says it expects to see a shift in new lending away from higher loan-to-value ratios as unemployment and impaired loans continues to rise while the housing market struggles. Since the government shut parts of the Australian economy in March to stop the spread of the novel coronavirus, the loan repayments of around 9.5% of all Australian mortgages have been deferred, and the government has pledged around $160 billion in fiscal stimulus, including billions for an employee subsidy expiring in September, that has helped limit job cuts in hard-hit sectors. Still, the Australian and New Zealand Banking Group, which is the country's fourth largest bank, last week said that around 14% of retail customers had applied for a home loan deferral and 7% were not receiving any salary income at all. Economists and analysts expect the extent of the fall in house prices and possible loan losses at banks will largely depend on further government support and stimulus beyond September. So the surge in home lending volumes did not translate to an improvement in the banking sector's underlying financial position. APRA's latest quarterly authorised deposits institution statistics have revealed that over the same period, the banks collectively recorded a 14.1% decline in their combined net profits from $34.3 billion as at the 31st of March 2019 to $29.4 billion a year later. And that's after tax. An 18.1% increase in capital provisions contributed to the earnings decline, with total provisions rising from $12.4 billion to $14.6 billion. And the banks were largely unimpeded by the COVID-19 crisis over the 3 months to the 31st of March 2020, with market volatility and a plunge in consumer sentiment triggered by lockdown measures imposed at the tail end of the quarter. Analysts are expecting the COVID-19 crisis to both dampen credit growth and undermine the bank's financial position over the coming quarters amid a spike in the unemployment rate. In recent months, the Big Four banks alone have set aside over $7.2 billion in credit provisions in anticipation of a COVID-induced deterioration in credit quality. And S&P Global Ratings has reported that it is forecasting an 85 basis point increase in credit losses across the Australian banking sector's loan portfolio in 2020. The 85 basis points increase, which is expected to moderate to 50 basis points in 2021, amounts to approximately $29 billion in gross loans, nearly six times higher than the record low back in financial year 19. And there was more data from the ABS today on lending flows for April. The number of loans to owner-occupiers for established homes fell by 6.3% during April 2020, commented the HIA. The ABS today released monthly data tracking lending activity, including lending within the residential property market for both new and existing homes purchased by owner-occupiers, investors and businesses. Home loans approved in April largely reflect loan applications initiated in previous months. The modest decline in finance approvals in April reflects processing delays due to COVID, they said. The housing finance across the market fell by 5% in the month of April. And while activity in the housing market slowed considerably in April, the housing finance data still remains elevated as lenders work through the backlog of loan applications. Loans for the purpose of constructing a new home are yet to be affected by COVID, increasing by 2.9% in April. Full finance approval is one of the final steps for home buyers who would have taken the decision to build a new home as far back as 2019. The value of loans to investors fell by 4.2% during April, and investors' lending in the 3 months to April 2020 was 6.6% lower compared to the previous 3 months. Despite a small decline in lending to first home buyers during April, first home buyers continue to represent 37% of the owner-occupied market, and that's the largest proportion since 2009. The volume of residential building activity is expected to decline through the rest of the year, and the government's Home Builder Scheme, First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, and the various state stimulus programs will be important in mitigating the extent to which this downturn weighs on the post-COVID economic recovery, they said. Across the states, the value of loans to owner-occupiers during the 3 months to April 2020 was higher than the previous 3 months, in Tasmania up 4%, New South Wales up 1.2%, and Victoria up 0.2%. Lending declined over this period in Queensland, down 3.8%, South Australia down 4.9%, Western Australia down 1.7%, the Northern Territory down 0.3%, and the ACT down 2.2%. A sharp increase in mortgage delinquencies was also recorded over the March quarter before lenders commenced offering mortgage repayment relief, according to Moody's. Moody's Investor Service has reported that over 30-day delinquency rates underlying Australian prime residential mortgage-backed securities increased to 1.79% in the 3 months to the 31st of March, up from 1.55% in the December quarter, and from 1.57% in the previous corresponding period. The major banks recorded the sharpest increase in delinquency, up from 1.2% to 2.28% quarter on quarter, and up 53 basis points from 1.75% in the March quarter of 2019. That was offset by a decline in delinquencies across Australia's regional banks, down in both quarterly and annual terms to 1.45%. However, the deterioration in credit quality preceded the rollout of repayment holidays from lenders in response to the COVID-19 crisis, which are exempt from delinquency reporting. According to the latest available data from the Australian Banking Association, approximately 430,000 home loan customers have deferred their home loan repayments in response to the COVID-19 crisis, equating to over $150 billion in mortgages. Nevertheless, Moody's Vice President and Senior Credit Officer Elena Chen is forecasting an increase in arrears over the coming quarters in response to the rising unemployment rate. Australia's unemployment rate increased to 6.2% in April from 5.2% in March, while underemployment increased to 13.7% from 8.8% over the same period, with the stressed economic conditions to constrain borrowers' ability to make mortgage repayments, he said. Moody's also noted that it expects Australia's GDP to contract 2.9% over the course of 2020. Government support measures, monetary easing policies, and lender relief initiatives will lessen but will not eliminate the risk of loan delinquencies and defaults over 2020, Mr. Chen added. S&P Global Ratings has also previously forecast a spike in arrears over the next 12 months, particularly upon the expiry of repayment holidays. The COVID-19 hardship concessions will assist many borrowers to transition through this period of stress, the ratings agency added. However, while not all of these loans are likely to move to formal arrears management and foreclosure after the hardship period ends, some of them are likely at a higher risk of default. Moody's has estimated that between 10 to 20% of lenders' mortgage portfolios are exposed to COVID-19 hardship assistance. Elsewhere, Slater and Gordon has filed the class action against Commonwealth Bank and alleges that the bank has admitted that the products were worthless despite selling to hundreds of thousands of customers. Slater and Gordon claims that existing policies have been rolled over and customers continue to be charged thousands of dollars in fees. A 2018 review of the bank's sale of consumer credit insurance products revealed that more than 200,000 people who were unemployed or not working full-time had been sold this type of policy, meaning it was very unlikely that they would be able to claim against the insurance, said Slater Gordon practice group leader Andrew Paul. This is reprehensible behaviour by the bank, which has chosen to compensate only a negligible portion of its customers, despite their admission that they knew the insurance was worthless. This move to return only a small portion of its customers' premiums seemed to have been tokenistic and an effort to protect the bank's brand, rather than a genuine attempt to make good its past wrongdoing. Slater and Gordon recently settled a class action against NAB for $49.5 million and has filed similar class actions against the ANZ and Westpac earlier this year. And over in the West, one of Perth's most prominent new home builders has raised concern that developers and builders are raising houses and land prices just days after state and federal grant announcements eroding the incentives before the first brick has been laid. Under the grants designed to keep the struggling housing sector going through the pandemic, new home builders in WA could receive up to $25,000 from the federal government's home builder scheme and $20,000 from the WA government's building bonus if they get a build underway by the end of the year. Ross North sales and marketing manager Shane Kasseri said just hours after the grants were announced, interest spiked, but he warned some parts of the industry had already increased prices or scrapped rebates to gouge customers. The display traffic in display villages has gone mental. There are people everywhere all of a sudden wanting to find out about building a house, he said. That has happened in, I would say, 75% of the land developers already. Mr. Kesley recalled an instance just days after the federal grant was announced where a developer sold a parcel of land from underneath a client 45 minutes before they were due to view the block. Imagine you and your partner had been mucking around for a while and then you think you've got your heart set, you've made the decision to do it, you've got the block on hold and suddenly the developer says it's not there anymore, they sold it. Urban Development Institute WA Chief Executive Tanya Steinbeck said the tactic was not something that she'd noticed, but the developers themselves were still trying to work out what the incentives meant for their customers. It's not something I'm aware of or have noticed yet, she said. All of our developers at the moment are working through clarification inquiries for the federal scheme in particular so that they can clearly communicate the incentive to purchasers. If there has been any removing of market collateral or marketing incentives, it would only be in preparation for the next step to communicate to consumers. A WA government spokeswoman said it developed the scheme with the sector's peak bodies and it was in the company's best interest to put their best offer forward to secure clients and guarantee they have a pipeline of work. We expect the market to be very competitive as a result of these grants, she said. But, I'd add, I've received anecdotal reports from WA that demolition builders are suddenly in demand to knock down old properties to rebuild with support from the poorly targeted stimulus measures. This is likely to push existing property prices down further whilst hiking the price of new builds. And finally, Stephen Roach, a faculty member at the Yale University and former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, and by the way, the author of Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China, wrote an opinion piece for Bloomberg titled, A Crash in the Dollar is Coming. The era of the US dollar's exorbitant privilege as the world's primary reserve currency is coming to an end. Then French Finance Minister Valéry Giscard d'Estaing coined that phrase in the 1960s, largely out of frustration, bemoaning a US that drew freely on the rest of the world to support its overextended standards of living. For almost 60 years, the world complained but did nothing about it, but those days are over. Already stressed by the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, US living standards are about to be squeezed as never before. At the same time, the world is having serious doubts about the once widely accepted presumption of American exceptionalism. Currencies set the equilibrium between these two forces, domestic economic fundamentals and foreign perceptions of a nation's strength or weakness. The balance is shifting, and a crash in the dollar could well be in the offing. The seeds of this problem were sown by a profound shortfall in domestic US savings that was glaringly apparent before the pandemic. In the first quarter of 2020, net national savings, which includes depreciation-adjusted savings of households, businesses, and the government sector, fell to 1.4% of national income. This was the lowest reading since late 2011, and one-fifth the average, which was 7%, from 1960 to 2005. Lacking in domestic saving and wanting to invest and grow, the US has taken great advantage of the dollar's role as the world's primary reserve currency and drawn heavily on surplus savings from abroad to square the circle, but not without a price. In order to attract foreign capital, the US has run a deficit in its current account, which is the broadest measure of trade because it includes investment. Every year, since 1982. COVID-19 and the economic crisis that it triggered is stretching this tension between savings and the current account to the breaking point. The culprit, exploding government budget deficits. According to the bipartisan Congressional Budget Office, the federal budget deficit is likely to soar to a peacetime record of 17.9% of gross domestic product in 2020, before hopefully receding to 9.8% in 2021. A significant proportion of the fiscal support has initially been saved by fear-driven unemployed US workers. That tends to ameliorate some of the immediate pressures on overall national savings. However, monthly Treasury Department data shows that the crisis-related expansion of the federal deficit has far outstripped the fear-driven surge in personal savings, with the April deficit 5.7 times the shortfall in the first quarter, or fully 50% larger than the April increment of personal savings. In other words, intense downward pressure is now building on already sharply depressed domestic saving. Compared with the situation during the global financial crisis, when domestic savings was a net negative for the first time on record, averaging minus 1.8% of national income from the third quarter of 2008 to the second quarter of 2010, a much sharper drop into negative territory is now likely, possibly plunging into the unheard of minus 5 to minus 10% zone. And that is where the dollar will come into play. For the moment, the greenback is strong, benefiting from typical safe haven demand, long evident during periods of crisis. Against a broad cross-section of US trading partners, the US dollar is up almost 7% over the January to April period in inflation-adjusted trade-weighted terms to a level that stands fully 33% above its July 2011 low, Bank for International Settlements data shows. But the coming collapse in savings points to a sharp widening of the current account deficit, likely taking it well beyond the prior record of minus 6.3% of GDP that it reached in late 2005. Reserve currency or not, the dollar will not be spared under these circumstances. The key question is what will spark the decline. Look no further, he says, than the Trump administration. Protectionist trade policies, withdrawal from the architectural pillars of globalization, such as the Paris Agreement on Climate, Trans-Pacific Partnership, World Health Organization, and traditional Atlantic alliances, gross mismanagement of COVID-19 response, together with wrenching social turmoil not seen since the late 1960s, are all painful, visible manifestations of America's sharply diminished global leadership. As the economic crisis starts to stabilize, hopefully later this year or in early 2021, that realization should hit home just as domestic saving plunges. The dollar could easily test its July 2011 lows, weakening by as much as 35% in broad trade-weighted inflation-adjusted terms. The coming collapse in the dollar will have three key implications. It will be inflationary, a welcome short-term buffer against deflation, but in conjunction with what is likely to be a weak post-COVID economic recovery, yet another reason to worry about an onset of stagflation. The tough combination of weak economic growth and rising inflation that wreaks havoc on financial markets. Moreover, to the extent a weaker dollar is symptomatic of an exploding current account deficit, look for a sharp widening of America's trade deficit. Protectionist pressures on the largest piece of the country's multilateral shortfall with 102 nations, namely the Chinese bilateral imbalance, will backfire and divert trade to other higher cost producers, effectively taxing beleaguered US consumers. And finally, in the face of Washington's poorly timed wish for financial decoupling from China, who will fund the saving deficit of a nation that has finally lost its exorbitant privilege? And what terms, namely interest rates, will that funding now require? Like COVID-19 and racial turmoil, the fall of the almighty dollar will cast global economic leadership of a savings-short US economy in a very harsh light. Exorbitant privilege needs to be earned, not taken for granted, he said. And I think that puts a finger on a very important point. There is a structural question here about the US dollar and its role going forward and how that flows through. And I suspect, unfortunately, the movement in the dollar will have significant negative impacts on the markets and on confidence, as well as the differential exchange rates between Australia and the US and other countries in the US. All of that underscores for me significantly more turmoil ahead, and one reason why I still don't believe that a V-shaped recovery is going to happen anytime soon. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.